we turn our attention this morning to a new series of lessons. Now, for a little while, you know, a couple of months probably, I'm going to be presenting a series that I think somewhat loosely maybe is going to revolve around a theme that is, in the physical world at least, a kind of a fascinating one, and it has relationship to spiritual things as well that is just truly profound. The lesson series is only going to last for a few weeks, but the principle will be the same in each one. And that principle is going to revolve around somewhat what you see on the screen right there. I've provided side by side two photographs, one looking up at the top of Mount Hermon. Mount Hermon is the highest point in Israel. It's not the highest point on earth, of course, but it is as high as you can go in Israel. Immediately adjacent to that is the shoreline of the Dead Sea there. Now, that, of course, is the lowest point on earth, not just in Israel, but on the entire planet. And so the two pictures represent extremes. On the list of book titles that most people on the planet would know, I'm pretty sure that the Guinness Book of World Records would probably be in the top five, or at least pretty high on that list. We love extremes. We are fascinated by the highest and the lowest and the fastest and the slowest and the biggest and the smallest and the farthest and the nearest. And anytime you can put an EST on the end of a word, I think, you know, we tend to just like it and be fascinated by it. So endless websites that present these kinds of statistics and whatnot. And so in this particular case right here in Israel, these people happen to have a very awesome visual reminder and representation of extremes. Again, you can see I've just cropped it very tightly, but on the left side you have the pinnacle of Mount Hermon, and on the right, again, a young child there on a beach next to the Dead Sea. Mount Hermon is 9,232 feet above sea level, and the Dead Sea is getting deader and lower every day, to the tune of about 3 feet per year. They are in the midst of a devastating drought and are now taking steps they began this year to try to figure out ways to take water from the ocean and see if there isn't a way to desalinate it so that it's potable and they can be drinking it and irrigating their fields, and yet also get it, you know, down into the Dead Sea where, you know, it can revitalize, if you will, a Dead Sea, but at least begin to raise the level. The roads that surround the sea are collapsing, sinkholes. There are hundreds of them now that have appeared. It's one of the most geologically active places on earth right now. And so in this country, all Israelis, in a country where it was only about 150 miles between these two points, you know, are well aware and can see almost the whole length of it, you know, of extremes. 10,644 foot difference, which is more than all of Mount Jefferson, the second highest mountain in Oregon. You know, that's a really, really big distance between the two. And they represent a maximum in height and a minimum in depth on the surface of the earth. I'm about to preach in this introductory lesson the single simplest lesson I may ever have presented in my entire preaching career. I'm going to show you a series of verses, quite a few, that are almost identical. But they serve to illustrate in the spiritual realm how God feels about maximums and minimums. How he feels about the most, the best, the all, the ultimate, and how he feels about minimums, the least, how little. I'll give you the illustration right at the outset. It is one that every preacher, unhappily, much to our dismay and disappointment, hear fairly regularly. You'd be surprised, maybe as disappointed as we are, to learn that there are just an awful lot of people who really want an answer to the question, do I have to go to the assembly on Sunday night in order to go to heaven? Do I have to come on Wednesday night? Do I have to be there for the Bible class? Can I still go to heaven? Preacher called me from a state I don't even know. He was ordering some of my recorded materials this week, and we got to talking, and he said, well, you must have heard the old joke, and I had to admit to him I had not. He said, well, the old story goes, how people love to concoct these mythical pictures of what judgment will look like. And typically you have St. Peter standing at the gate, and he's interviewing everybody as they go in. And so he tells me this joke that has that picture as the start. And there's miles, of a row of people standing in line at the gates of heaven waiting to get in. And then suddenly the people that are farther back realize that as they look ahead up this long line, there's some sort of activity and agitation. And obviously something's happening, and you can see people that are turning around and they're saying something to the ones behind them. And then you can hear this growing noise. And this noise is of people rejoicing and elated. And finally, it gets back to the back of the line. What's everybody talking about? What's everybody so excited? I said, hey, it turns out you don't have to go to the Sunday night assembly to get into heaven. Can you imagine? Well, I can tell you, it just breaks the heart of every preacher when anybody comes to them and asks, what's the least I can do? What is the Dead Sea of Christianity? What's the bottom that I can get by on? And not, what are the heights that I could climb? What are my opportunities? What is it more that I can do? Seldom I hear that question. I've heard it. But it breaks my heart. Because I know what's going on in the heart of the person that says, do I have to? I also know what's going in the heart of those who don't show up for the Bible class, don't show up for the evening assembly, don't show up for Wednesday night. Something in their life is considered greater, more important, somehow more urgent, more interesting, more something than what's being provided in a Sunday morning Bible class, a Sunday evening assembly, or a Wednesday assembly. And of course, the first thought for every preacher is, it's got to be my fault. It's got to be my failure. I'm going to decide what I want to preach. I'm going to try and present it as best as I know how. And if people don't want to hear it, then clearly I'm just not doing it right. It's my failure. So we do. Every preacher wrestles with it. He hopes that he grows. He thinks about all the different ways. And throughout the course of his career, typically, he'll try just about everything he can think of until he finally comes to the realization, if it's all up to me for people to get to heaven, then we're all doomed. It isn't up to me. It's up to you. And this question about how little can I get by with, if you're making that decision based on my skills, go find another church, please. As soon as you can. Sell your house to find a better one. Go anywhere. Go everywhere. Because, brethren, there's something going on in a heart, I think, not very healthy, that thinks in terms of what's the minimum. What do I have to? Rather than having burning within it an overwhelming passionate desire to do more, to be more, to know more, to love more fully, to be absolutely obsessed with all things that are spiritual, and for them to take precedence in your life so that no person starting with the preacher, can stop you, can prevent you from scaling the heights of the tallest mountain of spirituality that can be imagined. So I'm just going to go ahead this morning, I guess it is, and show you a series of scriptures that at least I think God, in His amazing, unceasing repetition, was apparently trying to really hammer in to our heads, beginning with Deuteronomy, though it's found in various forms in other places. I wanted to start with just the series in Deuteronomy. I realize now it's probably not as clear to read as I thought it was, but Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 26 through 30. I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that you will surely perish quickly from the land where you are going over the Jordan to possess it. You shall not live long on it, but will be utterly destroyed. The Lord will scatter you among the peoples, and you'll be left few in number among the nations where the Lord drives you. There you will serve gods, the work of man's hands, wood and stone, which neither see nor hear nor eat nor smell. But from there you will seek the Lord your God, and you will find Him if you search for Him with, does it say, the smallest part of your heart, the least that the preacher says you got to do of your soul. When you're in distress and all these things has come upon you in the latter days, you will return to your Lord and listen to His voice. I say not the first, but one of the clearest, where you have this sense that maybe a maximum is expected. It's all your heart and all your soul that will be necessary to find your God after He has destroyed you because of your minimums attitude prior to that. Once you've been punished, once you've been reduced to near oblivion, once you've lost this promised land before they even enter it, Moses on Mount Nebo can look out and see to the left and to the right, from Hermon to the Dead Sea that lies the northernmost edge of it at his feet. Don and I have stood there and looked at that on a very clear day. It's sobering to think of Moses speaking these words on that mountain before they even enter this promised land, flowing with milk and honey, filled with blessings of peace and freedom from invasion. They're being told, you people will not be in it very long. You're destined for captivity and destruction. Only after that, if you could find it in your heart to give all of your heart and all of your soul, then you'll find me. In the sixth chapter, verses 9 and 10 of this same book, Moses will also say, as he looks down across the Jordan Valley, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your might. These words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your sons, shall talk of them when you sit in your home, and when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. So two chapters later, this idea of wholeness, of entirety, of fullness, of extremes, of the most is again presented. But this time when it's presented, all your soul and all your might, he then immediately says, children, you're obsessed with these commands and you can't stop from teaching these things to your children. You're gonna teach them diligently. You're gonna talk about them. When you're sitting in your house and when you're walking by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up, because it's a maximum. It's everything that's on your mind. your heart. In Deuteronomy chapter 10, verses 12 through 14, four chapters later, what does the Lord require from you? Stop right there, because that's the question that we get. What does the Lord require? What's the bottom? What's the least? What's, you know, the lowest hurdle that I can clear? What does the Lord your God require from you? But to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all His ways, and love Him, and to serve the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and to keep the Lord's commandments and His statutes, which I'm commanding you today for your good. Behold, to the Lord your God belong heaven and the highest heavens, the earth and all that is in it. Close to perhaps a million people are standing on a mountaintop and looking out across the Jordan Valley, Hermon to the right, and the ridgeline that Jerusalem sits upon, right there. It is at that point, like 25 miles away, you can see three of the towers that are on the Mount of Olives from there. Here in this place, God brought these people after 40 years in the wilderness, and you know how they got there. They now are looking across that Jordan at the promised land, anticipating perhaps the question Moses is led by God to ask rhetorically: what does the Lord your God require? He requires fear. He requires walking in all His ways. He requires loving Him and serving Him with all your heart, with all your soul, keeping His commandments and statutes, because He is in the highest heaven, and the earth and all is in it belongs to Him. In the next chapter, and perhaps Moses is developing a theme that these Jews could recognize and we can as well, he now says in verses 13 through 16, it shall come about if you listen obediently to my commandments, which I am commanding you today, to love the Lord your God and to serve Him with all your heart and all your soul. Then He will give you the rain for your land in its season, the early and the late rain, that you may gather in your grain and your new wine and your oil. He'll give you grass in your fields for your cattle. You'll eat and be satisfied. Beware that your hearts are not deceived, and that you do not turn away and serve other gods and worship them. Well, this theme is, you know, unmistakable. When two chapters later in 13, verses 3 and 4, he says, the Lord your God is testing you to find out if you love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul. You shall follow the Lord your God and fear Him, and you shall keep His commandments, listen to His voice, serve Him, and cling to Him. Now, brethren, I'm just going quickly over the passages, but I'm hoping that as you're looking at them, you're noticing that each time He says the same thing about all your heart and all your soul and all your mind and all your might, you know, that there are other elements that He surrounds those principles with. Elements that first and foremost and always involve are those commandments and statutes, that you know them. They're familiar to you. They're on your heart all the time. You can and do teach them wherever you go, when you're sitting down, when you're walking, whatever. You're filled with this knowledge. Brethren, I know of only one way to get there. And it isn't by attending as few Bible classes as you can. That will surely not result in a mastery of Scripture that gives you a view of God's mind all the way to the throne where He sits. Every topic He's revealed from Genesis to Revelation. In the 26th chapter, verse 14, this day the Lord your God commands you to do these statutes and ordinances. You shall therefore be careful to do them with all your heart and with all your soul. chapter 30, verses 8 through 11. You shall obey the Lord and observe all His commandments which I command you today. Then the Lord your God will prosper you abundantly in all the work of your hand. Your prosperity depends on the observation of the commandments, not how great a businessman you are, not how much overtime you work. Your success, he teaches these people in this life, is dependent upon knowing and observing my commandments. Then the Lord your God will prosper you abundantly in all the work of your hand, in the offspring of your body, in the offspring of your cattle, in the produce of your ground. The Lord will again rejoice over you for good, just as He rejoiced over your fathers, if you obey the Lord your God to keep His commandments and His statutes, which are written in this book of the law. If you turn to the Lord your God with all your heart and soul, for this commandment which I command you today is not too difficult for you, nor is it out of reach. The Lord doesn't think He's asking too much when He asks for the pinnacle. In Joshua chapter 22, toward the end of the book now, after the people have come into this land and already made quite a few mistakes and paid for them with much loss of life, even as had been prophesied in the first of these Deuteronomy passages, in Joshua 22:5, be very careful to observe the commandment and the law which Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, to love the Lord your God and walk in all His ways. Keep His commandments and hold fast to Him and serve Him with all your heart and with all your soul. It's the maximum that God always had in mind. When we get to 1 Samuel chapter 7 and the years are passing and passing and the history of these people of failure and then repentance because of the punishment and then success for a while, then the inevitable failure yet again continues. Samuel, 1 Samuel 7, 3 and 4, spoke to the house of Israel saying, if you return to the Lord with all your heart, remove the foreign gods, think anything, covetousness is called idolatry, anything that comes between you and your God, anything. If you return to the Lord your God with all your heart, remove the foreign gods and the Ashtaroth from among you and direct your hearts to the Lord, serve Him alone, He will deliver you from the hand of the Philistines. So the sons of Israel removed the Baals and the Ashtaroth and served the Lord alone. 1 Samuel 12, Samuel again speaks to the people. Do not fear. You've committed all this evil. Yet do not turn aside from following the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart. You must not turn aside, for then you would go after futile things which cannot profit or deliver because they are futile. Brethren, I thought I should assign this, and I know I would be considered really stepping over the line. But for every one of you who is not in a Bible class on a Sunday morning, I know there are some who cannot be here. I know that. I know those who come to me and they're grieving that they can't come. They long to be here. Envy those who could. I'm not talking about them. But I just love to give the assignment. For everybody who does not attend the Sunday morning Bible class, would you please keep a diary, and at the end of each month, I'd like to know what you were doing in that hour. Just tell me. Since you have placed it above my efforts, above God's information, above joining with these people in the service and in the investigation of God's will, what were you doing this morning? Those of you who may have been here and chose not to be here, what were you doing that was so much more important? And tonight, I'd love to see the list. And then on Wednesday night, and after, I suppose, a few months of reading the list of all the things that people do instead of coming to a Bible class, instead of going to worship twice. I mean, that's just intolerable. How could God ask so much on a same day? And then to come back on a Wednesday night, do you know I got kids? You know, there were no kids in the wilderness. Don't you know? I got business. I got. I suppose if you would just give me that list, then I would know what to do, how to fix my preaching, so you would come. You think? Or would you learn something about yourself if you just did that? So I want to ask for the list, but I am asking you to think about it. What do you place above these assemblies? In 1 Samuel chapter 12, a few verses later, 23 through 25, far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord by ceasing to pray for you. Oh, that's something to think about. We just finished 1 Thessalonians, pray without ceasing in the New Testament. Here's Samuel, far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord by ceasing to pray for you. But I will instruct you in the good and right way. Only fear the Lord and serve Him in truth with all your heart. For consider what great things He has done for you, the ones you're placing above the Bible studies, for instance. I once had a woman tell me she didn't come to the Bible class on Sunday morning because she needed to tend to her roses. She told me this without any shame or embarrassment. It broke my heart. What do you say to a woman that would be in a garden with roses that God gave her, and in the Bible class it would teach her about the God who made them? I was speechless. But if you still do wickedly, both you and your king will be swept away, is the way that verse ends. And Jeremiah, it's been a lot of years now, Jeremiah 29:13 and following, you will seek me and find me when you search for me with all your heart. I will be found by you, declares the Lord. I will restore your fortunes, maybe even your roses. Will gather to gather you from all the nations and from all the places where I've driven you, declares the Lord. And I'll bring you back to the place from where I sent you into exile. In Matthew chapter 22, verses 26 through 40, in case you were thinking that these principles are just purely Old Testament principles, you know, and that's well and good for them, but God doesn't ask of us, you know, such things. I mean, why? Surely Christians are freed, you know, from the law. We wouldn't have to love Him with all our heart, would we? Serve Him with all our might? I mean, my, oh my, Christianity was to do away with that, wasn't it? Matthew 22, 26 through 40. Man comes to Jesus and says, Teacher, what is the great commandment in the law? And He said to him, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the great and foremost commandment. The second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend the whole law and the prophets. Brethren, that's Jesus still under the law, being asked by a lawyer, you know, about the law. I understand all of that. But what He just said is that everything depends, you know, upon loving the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind. You will find this same principle in numerous other places, and we're going to look at some of them in the next few weeks to come. But what I'm proposing is this. Every moment of every day, you are standing at a fork in the road making decision. And with God, it's all or nothing. With God, you either choose the things that you know He would have you do, or you choose the things that you know you want to do instead. One of the absolutely most terrifying scriptures that I know is this one in James 4, verse 17. The one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin. If ever, brethren, and be aware the next time you do it, if ever you say, well, I know I ought to, but soon as you utter that word in your mind's ear, I know I ought to, but whatever follows, brethren, if it is not a physical requirement. Sabra isn't with us this morning because she's suffering appendicitis in a hospital. I understand. But when you say, I know I should, but whatever follows comes from the devil himself. Whatever follows is you lying to yourself. Whatever follows is trickery, deception, temptation, and sin. When you know you ought to, but you won't, then you know you have sinned, regardless of what we're talking about. Taught driver's ed for 3 or 4 years in Washington and Oregon. We do not formally have minimum speed limits. Illinois does. There are laws that revolve around, you know, the minimums. But I pulled this sign, you know, freeway. You can see speed limit 70, minimum 45, this particular sign. Okay? Now, brethren, when you're driving your car, which one of those do you think about? Which one do you want more of? Which one appeals to you, fascinates you? Which one? The 70 miles an hour or the 45 miles an hour? Does anybody ever see a cop on the side of the road, he pulls over, he says, hey, how many miles less than 45 can I drive? Now, what are we all concerned about? We want to go more. So badly that we even have believed the utter lie, which I just researched again in Oregon State and actually read, that it's okay to go 5 miles over the limit. It's just a lie. Common misconception. But we're all wanting more. Not less. More. More and more. I'm insatiable. I'm in a hurry. Because I don't have long. When I die, I will not learn another thing in this life. I have only now to acquire all the knowledge that God has revealed, to become fluent in Bible speak, to know that language better than English, to know everything God expects of me, and to thrill to it, to love it. So, brethren, look, I understand. I really do. Some things get in the way, and you cannot. God knows. When Joseph was sold into slavery, I suppose he didn't get to just walk on home. But while Joseph was in slavery, he served the God with his of heaven with his whole heart, his whole mind, his whole soul, and with all of his strength, didn't he? From his jail cell, from slavery, in 13 years, from 17 to 30, how far did he climb? From the pit, the slave trader's sail, to second in command of the superpower of the day. What was Joseph's attitude? It's what we're studying on Sunday nights. More than 50% of you won't know that because you weren't here last Sunday night when we started it. Every once in a while, it is incumbent upon me to just unburden my heart, if you will, and say to you, if you're thinking that you don't have to go to a Bible class, a second worship service, or a Wednesday night class in order to go to heaven, you are right. And with that attitude, you don't have to go to heaven either, and you likely won't. That's the simple fact. If Scripture means anything, that's just the simple fact. Because God isn't concerned about how many hours you put in. He's concerned about whether or not when he looks at your heart, he sees about an hour's worth of worship. He sees about an hour's worth of interest. He sees about an hour's worth of concern for him in a week. Brethren, let's change that. Yes, like every other church in America, we are shrinking. Yes, this congregation is getting to critical mass. And yes, you have a role to play in it. What role is that? Food for thought. Now, it took me 6.5 years to get here because you know I love you. In fact, I wouldn't have done this except the elders asked me to. Brethren, I respect you. I know some of you really are giving your all. But I'm hurt to my core at how few of you can stomach me, your brethren, or your Bible, any more than the hour we just spent. So today you get the shot. Do with it what you will. I would like to see the list of what you're doing when you're not here. If you're bold enough to write it out and bring it to me, I'll do the best I can to help you get over those obstacles so that you can go to heaven without a cry of relief. Oh, what do you know? I was sure worried about it, but I don't have to go more than once on Sunday. Thank you for your attention. Let's do it together. To the work, brethren, whosoever will. If I can be a personal help, one of the elders, please let it be known as we stand and sing.